You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Harry Moritz. Harry, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Harry, you're talking to me from your studio in Brooklyn. Tell me a little bit about what's happening in your studio. Do you have a studio you can walk to from your apartment?
Yes.
Or you,
so,
yeah, okay.
Yeah, I live about two blocks from my studio in Bushwick. So I have a smaller space and a larger warehouse. My studio also functions. I mean, my work kind of entails machining work. I work full-time as a machinist. And so with the current situation, as far as working from home, I'm actually working on a project for the job that I usually have, and I usually commute into Manhattan for that. So I've been going into the city, picking up large quantities of brass, taking a taxi back to my studio, and just running the doorknobs, basically, from my own studio, and then bringing them back the following week.
So this is what you're making. I mean, just to be clear, what you're doing for your machinist job, you're making brass doorknobs?
Yeah, I mean, that's just today. And then, I mean, I've been working on a lot of new sculpture. I mean, this whole coronavirus situation has really, I mean, honestly, for me, has been pretty amazing because I've been working 5 days a week for about 4 years straight now, and this is the first time I've had now it's been 2 months where my schedule every day is what I want, and I'm two blocks from my studio, and I'm doing my sculpture, and then I'm doing other work and making money off of that, and then it's been going fairly well for me in this last 2 months.
And how has the lockdown changed that? Because you're one of the rare people in New York right now that are even kind of mobile and going out there, but how has the lockdown change that, just like something less hectic, or what happened?
Well, yeah, it's very quiet. You know, the city is right now, most places are closed. I mean, you know, sometimes, like, I walk through the city or I walk through Brooklyn, you see a restaurant or a cafe that's only open for takeout, or, you know, there's a deli, maybe you get a burrito to go, and you're standing behind like a plastic sheet between you and the cashier. It's very bizarre, but and then I get to my studio and everything's normal in here. I mean, I'm in a great place right now. I'm in a great place because I spent so much time last year kind of setting this studio up, and then I moved to the neighborhood, and then, you know, that was about 6 months ago, and then now this whole thing hit. And I'm kind of, like, well-prepared for it, and I'm very fortunate that I'm in the place that I am right now. I mean,
Let's talk about that place. What's happening in there? What sculpture are you making?
So with your
tone, it sounds like, you know, there's some, I get the sense that there's some something magical going on in there, or wizardry is how I kind of imagine it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, right now I've been exploring my own gender sexuality for years, and then I'm kind of finally putting that into my work, and I'm looking at this piece that's totally finished. It's these aluminum bottles. You know, I can produce like large quantities of the same thing on this computerized automatic lathe that I have. So I made these bottles, and then within the bottles there are queer porn images, meaning like men sucking a dildo of like that a woman's holding, or like an image of like someone in drag. But these images are embedded into these bottles, and then
they're on the inside of the bottle, so you really have to kind of look into them.
Right. Well, so they're on the inside, but I actually have to cut away material to then insert this image. Then once the image is there, then I take a piece of plexiglass and I epoxy that and let it dry overnight. So then I basically have a window. Then from there, I put the bottle back onto the lathe and I turn down that rectangular shape of plexiglass that I've just glued into the bottle, and I basically smooth it, and so it creates the same, so it goes with the contour of the round bottle. So it's kind of like this window that you're that is obscured because it's still kind of blurry, but you see these images. I mean, and then within that, there are these two bottles right now I'm looking at with these two different queer sex images, and they're inside of a mini fridge door. And on the top of the fridge door, there's a section for eggs, about 8 eggs. And so I made aluminum eggs, again, on the lathe. And so I have these aluminum eggs on the top. So it kind of has this this sort of reference to some kind of fertility, you know, despite like a fake penis of like a dildo. So, I've been really thinking about this kind of like juxtaposition of like a queer sexuality, but still perhaps with some kind of straightness mixed in there. And then it's, yeah, and I'm in this place where my thoughts are finally wandering and I'm really exploring.
So let's talk about that a little bit because that piece sounds like, yeah, where like thinking about gender all these years has got you. How is that piece used? This is a little bit like a bottle. Are you picking it up and looking in it, or as a sculpture, it seems like it's interactive. I know it's a hard thing to maybe describe here, but that would be...
Well, in a way, you know, you kind of view it in a sense. I mean, I have this fridge door mounted to a wall. So in a sense, it's like a wall piece. And so you're looking at it as if you're looking at kind of a painting, I would say. I mean, I have it set up on these kind of custom hinges, so it actually does swing open and close to kind of like at least retain like that reference to like a functioning fridge. So you're kind of viewing it from the wall, or as a viewer, you're looking at it from the way you'd see it as a painting. A lot of the work, I've been interested in like this, like where, like, for, and this has been for years, where like the industrial aspects of our society, where do they come into like the domestic space? I've kind of like gone in waves in and out of that those ideas, and then
so let's
right
talk
now,
about that, because that's interesting, because of course you're we can talk about exactly what you're working on now, but even that bottle you were talking about, that's kind of an example of that, isn't it? That's you know, you're using industrial methods to, if I understand correctly, make this also this type of bottle, right? And that's you know, which isn't normally how it's done. It's is that the case? What's the material of the bottle?
They're aluminum.
Aluminum, right.
Yeah,
You know, it's such a weird material to make a bottle out of, but because you're using this process, you can. And uh-huh. So, yeah, tell me a little bit more about that, because that is also a theme that kind of runs through your work, right?
Yeah. I've been working as a machinist now professionally for 5 years. I've been working particularly in the brass decorative architectural hardware industry, and so I'm always surrounded by brass and bronze, and I have this, like, I think the brass and the bronze take on this kind of, like, I mean, it's very high-end and it's very decorative, and then, you know, I've always been interested in like, the utility of machines and machining, and so I really feel that, you know, aluminum as this kind of, like, lighter silver, you know, less kind of fancy, more industrial look, that's like really what I've been using mostly in my work lately is just primarily aluminum. I mean, and again, I made eggs that are made out of this solid aluminum. It's just that.
And why aluminum? I mean, to me, is it aluminum or aluminium, right?
Aluminum. I mean, yeah, it depends. Sometimes people say aluminium.
But it's the same material, right? And so how is that solid aluminum? I mean, I've heard of solid aluminum, but it's a material that I don't really understand. It's like a block,
So all of the raw material that I get is just a cylinder. So, you know, you think of like a disc or a rod, like a 1 foot long by 3 inch diameter, but it's just a solid round piece. And then from there, I have on my machine, I do all of the programming, and then I can set up the material and I can run the part. So, you know, if I had an idea, I wanted to make 100 bottles, like, you know, I would do it. I could do that in probably a couple days. you know, and it would be just a very repetitive process. It's just like put the metal in, you know, set up part of the machine, then just press go, let it run, take it out, take the finished piece out, put the next raw material in, and run it again. And I mean, that's, you know, I went to Pratt for fine arts, and then I did another, you're in New Haven. I grew up in Connecticut, and then so after Pratt, I went to school in Bridgeport. I did a advanced manufacturing certification program. So I, you know, I have a certificate in as a machinist and my degree in fine arts. You know, because once when I was at Pratt, I became very interested in machines and machining, and knew like that would be my kind of career or my day job. I mean, I get paid well and I get good benefits, and I like doing it. And it's fed directly into my work. So much what I think about being an artist is not only just making work, but it's kind of like making your own kind of reality and kind of like manipulating certain aspects of life or certain situations. And I mean, like 3 years ago, I got hired to work at the company that I'm still working for, and they didn't have any of these advanced machines. So I said, you know, I just learned how to do this. If you buy a machine like this, then I'll run it. So they said, okay, Harry, which machine should we buy? And I had always thought, you know, this one machine I think would be best for making sculptures, you know, once I learn it. So I said, okay, buy this one. I learned it. I picked it up pretty quick. And then about a year and a half later, I bought a used one. And so that's what I have in my studio now. and I really think that, like, it's about, like, really finding, like, some kind of, like, in my case, it was, like, this career that was going to really help me move forward with the sculpture I wanted to make, but it was also going to be a way to make money, but then also a way to learn, keep learning skills that would keep feeding into my work.
And that's worked out really well. I mean, you're in the situation where you're taking advantage of all of those things. It's unusual where a college trajectory ends up actually working out, like, so well.
Right. I learned manual machining at Pratt, and then I did that other program, got introduced to the more advanced machines, and then, you know, started working in the industry, worked in, like, a factory, like, in Connecticut, you know, making, like, little screws and parts for, like, Ford cars and things like that. When I moved back to Brooklyn, I worked at it in, like, another decorative company. And now the company I'm working for now that I've been at for 3 years, they've been around since 1857. And they're in the West Village on Jane Street. And it's this building. They moved from, like, the original owner moved from, like, Canal Street to this building in the West Village back in, like, in 1900. So they've been there ever since.
It's amazing. What do they manufacture? Like, I didn't think there was any manufacturing in the city at all anymore.
I know. They're manufacturing doorknobs. I mean, high-end, very high-end decorative hardware. You know, there's a full foundry on the top floor. I mean,
on Jane Street? You said on Jane Street?
Yes, Jane Street and 8th Avenue.
And it's amazing. There's a foundry on the top floor.
Yeah. Right.
You must know the scene in New York. Is that the last foundry in Manhattan, or are there others?
No, it's the last foundry in Manhattan. It's possibly, I'm not sure of other foundries. Well, I know Pratt has a foundry in Brooklyn, so that's one, but I'm not sure of many other foundries in the city. But yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking like old wooden creaky floors. You know, the bathrooms feel like an outhouse when you're inside. You know, there's over 50 people in that building. You know, if there's a leak upstairs, it's coming down to your floor. You know, it's just like, it's really like old school. And so for me, like, I've been there now for 3 years, but I've had a pretty big impact there. I mean, I've brought in now, just before this whole corona crisis, they had just bought another machine, another CNC machine, and, you know, they have to haul it up the stairs. You know, they put a steel plate down underneath to help support it, but the floor still shakes a bit. I mean, yeah, it's, you know, and then you look at the owner. He, like, I went in just yesterday to bring some parts by that I had finished in my studio, and I walk in, the owner's just sitting there smoking a cigar, and I say to him, "Oh, you got the house to yourself now." You know, it's like, because typically people don't, the other workers in the office don't let him smoke, but since it's a reduced staff, you know, it's a little more free right now in the building, I guess. It's very silly.
Amazing.
Yeah. But I
Amazing.
mean,
That's
I
amazing
really,
because almost all of
yeah.
that has moved to New Jersey now, right? Whatever was in New York,
Right,
I would imagine it's all in New Jersey or
exactly.
further
So
out.
much, so much. And, like, you know, I have my resume on this website, Indeed, which I've gotten all of my machinist jobs off of. And I'm getting all these emails lately from Springfield, New Jersey, people, like these managers saying, "Can you come work here?" Like, no. I mean, I've been, you know, in addition to my work and then, like, as far as sculpture, and then I have this full-time job. I also have my own company, and I'm doing design pieces, lamps and clocks. So that's Huma Lathe, and that's I've had that for about 2 to 3 years. And so, I mean,
So
that's another way that
your
I'm,
design business, of course, is like that's another kind of sphere of your work. There's what you're doing in the city and your sculpture that we've been talking about, but then your design work is how does that go out into the world? Is that through
I mean,
other boutiques or?
I've tried, but you know, it's hard if you don't have like a big name just yet. So these design boutiques, sometimes they're receptive and they'll buy some and resell it, but often I've just been direct to consumer. I mean, people find me on Instagram or I mean, I was in what helped was I was in this big clock show at Jack Hanley Gallery back in November. And I started to meet some more people through that. But I mean, still, it's, you know, it's a slow, it's, I see it's kind of a slow thing, but it's okay. It's just, you know, I mean, I get commissions to make big lamps sometimes or make a small candle holder or, but yeah, lately it's been pretty consistent as like an additional income. But again, it's great to, I just, it's just another thing I'm doing in my studio, where my studio is like functioning also as a business. But you know, I'm not, I may not be selling sculpture, but I'm selling lamps, you know, or I can make doorknobs and then and make sculpture at the same time. It's kind of it's very I have a lot of different ways that I can, you know, use the space and have it work for me. You know, not only artistically, but in a very functional way, in a practical way. Which,
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, and in New York is, you know, the rent is very high here. It's kind of
It's rare to find a
necessary.
balance like that. Yeah, in New York that's rare,
Right.
but it's rare anywhere to find a balance between your work and your art where one doesn't interfere with the other, but in your instance they each feed each other. Well, maybe the art doesn't feed your day job, but your day job does feed your art in terms of working with materials and I would imagine, right?
I mean, yeah, and you know, I can, like, you know, take a couple extra pieces of brass from the building, you know, and bring it home and make some sculpture. Or I mean, I'd say my life has been pretty, like, everything in my life has been pretty intertwined, like, in the last few years. And then, I mean, like, last year I was renting a studio. I was actually in the East Village. I had a studio in a basement on Fifth Street and Bowery, which I was only there for a year, but I was really just attached to the idea because it's like this kind of old-time New York artist life, and I was living in Chinatown and working in the West Village, and I thought I had everything. And then, you know, kind of, I just kept kind of mulling over, like, if I just, you know, move to this other studio in Brooklyn, pay a little bit more rent, but I'll be able to get my machine, you know, it'll all be worth it. And I mean, and I took that step, and I'm so glad I did it when I did, because now we're, you know, now we're at a, in a point in our society where moving and buying machines and setting up a studio is a lot more difficult.
It sure is.
You know, yeah. So,
Well, good to hear you're in a good position. And I want to ask you also what you're reading at the moment. I'm always curious what everyone's reading. What are you reading at the moment?
So right now, I read a book at night and a book in the morning. So the book at night is The Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States, which has been it's put so much into perspective for me as far as where we're at in this culture. And I really do believe in karma. When I think of karma and I think of how this country was founded, it's just as like, it makes a lot of sense where we're at right now. And as a country, you know, where the settler soldiers that came from Europe and colonized this territory and killed so many indigenous people, it's like, you know, okay, like, and set up the United States, essentially. You know, the United States has some unraveling to do, and I think that whether it's we're doing it consciously or there's a kind of greater force that's pushing us in a certain direction, I mean, I think this coronavirus perhaps is related to that sort of, like, kind of history, I think. You know, that lineage that America was founded on. So I've been really thinking about that a lot. And then in the morning I read Duchamp. I mean, I reread the afternoon interviews. And, I mean, he kind of ends by saying he believes in the artist.
The afternoon interviews, that was with, who did those afternoon interviews? That was
Calvin Tompkins,
right, because he just put a whole volume, all those, so go on, what was he saying in it that's memorable of the afternoon interviews with Duchamp? Yeah,
yeah.
It was a wonderful series.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Duchamp, well, what I have always appreciated about Duchamp is his unwillingness to work, where, I mean, not that he didn't, like, you know, his relationship to work, and that he... You know, there's something just about walking through the streets and kind of observing, or sitting and playing chess. I mean, sitting on a bench, like, you know, and that's kind of been a big part of who I am, like, for a long time, where I can sit in a chair or I can sit on a bench in a park for hours and do absolutely nothing. And that's kind of what I appreciate about this time right now, is just like this, take it slow, like, stay safe, like, don't push yourself too much. And I'm kind of like yesterday, I mean, I dropped some parts off to the job, and then I just sat on a bench, and then I went to another park and I sat on another bench. I did that all day. But yeah, I mean, and then towards the end of his interviews, he says he appreciates the artist, you know, more than the art itself. And I think that I think that kind of goes back to perhaps what I was saying earlier about manipulating your environment and seeing like life as a material itself, like where, like the relationship that I have to the owners and the managers of the company that I have has been in a way that I've kind of like, you know, sure they've made money off of me and my skill set, but I've kind of like persuaded them to make certain decisions and to kind of like act in secretly my favor. And, you know, that, and it took time, you know, it wasn't just like overnight I had everything. And, but over time, you know, I kind of like worked out a situation and negotiated in a way. And then now I'm sitting in front of, you know, I'm sitting in my own place thinking like, you know what, it kind of worked out. and I think that is a work. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's like, that kind of interaction, that kind of like ongoing building and kind of like having an intention, and then like ultimately like you kind of land and you're like, boom, I like made that, but it took a long time.
Right.
You know, it took a few years, but I mean, again, any good work takes time. I mean, yeah, Duchamp worked on his glass piece for, you know, I mean, maybe he could say he never actually finished it, because then it broke and then he never wanted to fix it. It didn't really matter.
Really.
Yeah.
Well, Harry, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.